17 April is the International Day of Peasant Struggles. One may be inclined to think that such a day has very little significance for places like Europe and other parts of the developed world, but one would be mistaken. Struggles over farmland are a very real reality in Europe, although the nature of these struggles differs across the continent, with the main differences being between Eastern and Western Europe. There are threats of land grabbing by large transnational companies and investors. Farmland is converted to other uses, such as infrastructure, energy projects, urban sprawl, for example. More generally, market forces make it very difficult to make a living as a small independent operator who wants to produce food locally rather than for the world market in an ecological way. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast. My name is Sean Macheza. In this special episode, we get to hear inspiring stories from those who are farming in order to support life-sustaining economies in line with principles of agroecology, food sovereignty, and community-supported agriculture. My colleague and your host for this episode, Sylvia Kay, speaks to our guests, Attila Socks, Yoke Demul, and Samson Hart. They also talk about the role of spirituality, feminism, and the legacy of communism in European land and farming.
Welcome to the podcast. We're here at La Bergerie de Villacre, which translates as a sheepfold, I discovered. A beautiful location just about 45 minutes outside Paris. And we're here for 3 days seminar on local land struggles in Europe. And I'm here with three really great participants that I'm thrilled to have be part of the podcast. And I think I will allow them to introduce themselves each, and we're going to have a nice chat, informal conversation about, really kind of land strategies and but what I hope we get to is really the kind of heart of it. You know, why are we really engaged in the struggle for land or the defense of land for communities, for agroecology, for new farmers, for peasants, for European citizens as well? What is the kind of driving force behind it? Where are the challenges? You know, where can we do better? Where must we do better? And I hope we can all speak a bit from our own personal experiences, you know, because I think we each bring our own personal experience, not just from the countries that we live in, but the places we have been, the people we have met. We each bring our own particular wisdom, I think, to this topic. So I'm hoping we can have a nice chat from that perspective. But let's hear who we have on the podcast. So perhaps I'll turn to you, Yoke. Could you just briefly introduce yourself and who you are, what are you up to now?
My name is Yoke. I am a 41-year-old farmer from the Netherlands. At the moment I'm a vegetable farmer, but if you'd told me that 25 years ago, I would have laughed in your face.
Why would we have laughed in your face?
I'm not from farming background. I'm one of the typical new entrants. Well, it's typical for our kind of farming to have new entrants in the way of farmers who do not come from farming background and who generally do not come from farming as a first choice of career. I started my professional farming career when I was 33. The garden, vegetable garden, was growing up my favorite place because I was usually hungry as a child. So I was always in the vegetable garden because there I could eat.
You had your food sovereignty, your food autonomy, right from
So that is part of why I'm in food and farming, because I'd like to be indeed sovereignty in food autonomy. I'd like to have control over my own food. I love food. And I like to feed people. I don't want anybody else to be hungry, and I think it's the most logical thing to make your connection to the ground to do. It's the foundation of our life. Without food, we have no life. And food is also healthcare. Medication is sick care, food is healthcare, in my opinion. So it makes an integrated approach that suddenly, after high school, traveling the world and thinking, seeing how we destroy the world and how we poison it, and then going to Wageningen University, studying forest and nature management, and then seeing how distorted in many ways thinking and ideas and practices were there. Then I did 10 different jobs, including bookselling. But then I went to live in a van in England, as somebody else here.
I think that's something that a number of people in this podcast have in common.
Yeah, to discover myself, as you do. And then found ground and found home in an apprenticeship of organic growing. And there, suddenly, all the bits of my life felt like they come together in a logical sense. And I feel, now I'm coming home. This is my purpose. This is where I find my joy, my grounding, and my sense. And making the whole thing logical of making real food available for real people and making connections again. Food and farming for me is a connecting tool to each other. I say I farm communities, I farm happiness, and I farm vegetables. I just tend to only get paid for the vegetables.
I think we might return to that, you know. That's perhaps that's a nice transition to, actually, I think we have quite a bit in common in the podcast participants, because I know someone else has lived in a van, has done a kind of apprenticeship, or sort of is still doing kind of skill kind of shares, and is actually implementing their skills that they learnt through a kind of ecological and farming training course. So, Samson, can I ask you to say a bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Samson. I'm 26, and I grew up in quite a conventional way of life. Very urban, very removed from the land, you know, never really imagined a possible future on the land. And in the past 4 or 5 years, I've been on a huge transformational journey that's led me right back to the earth in a way that is, that I can't imagine a future that isn't that way. So right now I'm living on a small market garden. We grow vegetables for 50 families in the local village. It's beautiful, humble work that is endlessly fulfilling on a daily basis, because to build a relationship with life, which is what you have to do to farm well and to farm in a way that is convivial and to farm in a way that allows you to think in generational terms. It's spiritual work, in my opinion. It's to like grow something from seed and believe that the universe will turn a seed into food for you and your community is a spiritual act. And I think for me, that's a big part of why I farm. The fulfillment is just endless. And I describe myself as an earth-based Jewish diasporist, which is quite a mouthful.
Okay, but, can you repeat that?
I'm an earth-based Jewish diasporist.
Jewish diasporist.
So what that means is quite a radical thing in my heart and in my mind, because for my people, the Jewish people, we've been very detached from land for a very long time, and there's a dominant story that the only way we could have land is through having a nation state and having power and territory. But at my vision of diasporism, which is to say that I declare myself, I see my homeland as the ground beneath my feet wherever I stand. So wherever we're scattered, we need to find ways to connect deeply to those places, and ways to connect deeply and trust that we will be able to stay there for a long time. because the history of the Jewish people is of moving around, of being expelled, of being banished, and to challenge that story through connecting to land again is a big journey of mine. So yeah, that's one of my other pieces, and I write poetry because that's what farming and being on the land invokes for me. Fukuoka, Masanobu Fukuoka, mm-hmm. used to say, well, says in the classic book, which probably influenced a lot of people to go back to the land, in the One Star Revolution, he says that, you know, there was a time when Japanese farmers would have time to write poetry and haikus in the winter months. And, you know, the relationship between culture and land and arts and poetry are so intertwined. So I'm really interested in bringing those back together. So, and then I guess on top of all that, I don't know how I'm going too far, is that there's a political element that I think in the West, there's a huge back to the land movement for sure, and there's lots of young people getting involved in farming. And I question, are we thinking deep enough, and are we going far enough to create truly liberatory land-based movements? And what I mean by that is land-based movements that are accessible and inherently accessible to people of color, to queer folks, to women, because I think a lot of our movements are very they very easily replicate certain aspects of capitalism and patriarchal societies unless we challenge those like explicitly. And so I'm really interested in that as well.
I definitely want to dive deeper into that, because that's I think something that sounds really fascinating to get your takes on. Tilla.
Well, it's kind of hard to top that, Samson.
I brought a resident.
It's not a competition.
I know. I'm kidding. I'm coming. Yeah. So my name is Attila Söcs, I am. At the base of my heart, an agroecological enthusiast and rural dweller. At least that my Twitter account says that.
Very catchy Twitter handle.
I think listening also to your life stories, my life story is much more traditional, in the traditional sense of tying to the land, in the figure that my family is a peasant descendants. So I come from Romania, which is in Eastern Europe, and it's one of the largest peasant populated countries in modern Europe right now. So we have almost 4 million peasant farmers in Romania, and to be a peasant is not just it's not just farming the land. It's also almost all that connection that you, Samson, are talking about, is this spiritual connection with the land, this cultural connection to the land, the value of the commons and the value of helping each other, and know that if your neighbor goes, if your neighbor doesn't live well, then you will not live well. So I come from that family background. My great grandfather and grandmother, and they were all peasants of the land. And then something happened in all of our families in Romania. It's communism, and communism sort of this kind of like political system really disrupted the link with the land of my family. So I was not born into a farm into farming. I was actually born in a city and raised up in a small town, and I was always just visiting my grandparents, who were struggling to farming, because at that moment in the 90s it was really hard to farm after the fall of communism. So I was always feeling that something is missing from my life, and that's why I turned to agroecology and agronomy. And I did an agronomy university in Cluj, one of the largest university bases in Romania. And I was not satisfied, because doing agronomy in Romania right now, it teaches you how to destroy soil, how to destroy climate, the land, how to poison food and sell that poisoned food. So even that was not enough, I think, for my revelation. And after that, I hired myself into a company that was even more like a financial institution that was sort of aiding farmers to get access to European funds. And basically what I found out is in the middle is that it was basically using farmers so that the company can generate revenue. And that really made me angry, like that my daily job is to dupe farmers into creating some failed projects so that somebody else can get rich, long story short. And that was my final revelation when I said I really want to work and live for those people who are being basically bullied in Romania, which are the small farmers. They are the ones whom I saw every day coming in with aspirations in the office. And then after a few months of fails, seeing their desolate faces while they were leaving from the office. And of course, their money stayed in the office. So for me, it was a very, very drastic move. Then I said, okay, I move to the civil society sector, to the social movement sector, and to try to involve myself and to reconnect it with my ancestors and with the ones that still represent the peasant farming fabric of Romania. So that's how I became. I hired myself at Eco Ruralis, which is a peasant farmers organization. It's the only one in Romania which is truly like working as a peasant union in Romania. And we are organizing ourselves in a very horizontal way. And I found myself into this very accepting environment where agroecology is promoted, where food sovereignty is promoted, where we are standing up together for the peasant rights. So the final step in my life was to actually connect to a farm. So since 3 years now, my wife and me, we managed to buy a small farm 70 kilometers away from Cluj, the city where we have the Eco Ruralis headquarters, and we started farming. So basically we have a fruit farm, we have a mixed vegetable farm, we make hay, we make all kinds of processed foods. And it was an instant connection. Both my wife and I, when we found this farm, which was laying empty for 10 years, when we touched the household, we started to cry. And that was an immediate connection with the land, with everything. I even felt some of the past of those people. And then I found pictures of those people who were farming there. And everything was intact. It was like stand in the time. So we just continue what has been put down. So that's a little bit of my life story and how I got to work in Eco Ruralis. And obviously I can tell more about Eco Ruralis.
But what I feel so deeply with all three of you is this kind of deep personal connection you have, you know, with land, with food production, with building up a kind of food sovereignty community, you know. So this is not, it's so different to how the globalized agriculture is nowadays, which has, you know, output maximization, exhaustion and degradation of the resource base to get the most out of it, you know, to squeeze it up every last, you know, sort of useful drop of water or micronutrients, you know. So I feel that, you know, it's so much more than that for you. It's really on many, many levels, a social, political, spiritual act, you know, farming and
definitely
being on the land. Yeah, that's. But I want to perhaps then touch a bit on the political dimension a bit more, and especially since a number of you are also really affiliated and very much even founding members of political organizations that work and stand up for the rights of peasant farmers. So perhaps Attila, I could actually ask you to start a bit about how was Eco Ruralis set up. I know that you were right there from the beginning. What was your aim and intention with starting Eco Ruralis?
Well, definitely, like Eco Ruralis came as a response in Romania for the huge social pressure that peasants were feeling at that moment. So that was 2009. In 2009, it was right in the middle of the CAP discussions of that moment, the Common Agricultural Policy discussions of the EU, Romania being a fairly new member state. And suddenly, through the accession of Romania to the European Union, the Europe inherited this wonderful legacy of 4 million peasant farmers at that time. So it completely changed the social farming fabric of the EU. And although it was such a wonderful legacy in Romania, it was completely disregarded. So all the CAP discussions, they were running very much forward towards industrialization, supporting big subsidies for big farmers, for chemicization and all these aspects. And basically how Eco Ruralis started is that a few farmers, peasant farmers from different regions of Romania came together and said, we need our own voice. It's not good that others, academia, NGOs, even the government is distorting our voice and telling, oh, the peasant should do this and the peasant should say that and they probably think that. We need our own voice. So they said, okay, let's do a union of peasants. And then quickly they looked at the nomenclature, the job descriptions of what is a peasant, and guess what, in Romania you cannot have a peasant union because there's no such such description of a job as being a peasant. You can be a farmer, you can be a steel worker, you can be a jurist, a lawyer, but you cannot be a peasant. It's not recognized as a vocation. So how can you do a union on something that is not recognized? So in the eyes of the state, the peasants were either landowners, so self-employed, or unemployed, so social welfare. And it was neither of them was character, or all of them, you know, was character. So then we said, okay, we establish an organization, but because we couldn't do a union, we did an NGO. But from the beginning, the working mechanisms were very similar to a union. So we have a coordination committee, we have a general assembly, we have working groups, and we make very consensual decisions. And also we have mechanisms through which we facilitate the presence and articulation of women, of youth, so all these kind of very horizontal mechanisms, how we think a union of peasants should work. And we started with 5 members, 2009, and now 10 years from that moment, we grew to almost 12,000 members from all over Romania. And our vision is... it's a society which is, and a farming society which is, has economic justice, has a social role in producing food for local markets, which is employing the political concept of food sovereignty and agroecology, peasant agroecology, and through which the peasants are the center of our food system in Romania. And their voice is being not just heard, but recognized and implemented in public policy. So that is basically the strong vision of Eco Ruralis. And through this, we started to work on to develop several areas of work based on different themes like seeds or land or markets or transversal areas where we talk about women's rights, peasant women's rights, or we talk about youth and the farming generational renewal, or address to different kind of political contexts like the common agriculture policy, or even higher up policies in the FAO, which are the United Nations Declaration on Rights of Peasants, or developing or using tools like the voluntary guidelines of the Ontenion. So we from start began not as a service providing NGO, because that's not what we want to do. This is a political NGO, it's a social movement that delivers its own voice towards who wants to hear it.
Is the voice of the peasants.
Yes,
in Romania.
And it's a voice of the peasants and the transforming peasant society. Mm-hmm. Because peasants are not a romantic idea kept in time. And it's a romantic idea of the 1800s before industrialization, when you have the serfs and the peasants and the free peasants. And no, peasants have evolved through communism, through early capitalism. They became landowners. No, they became smallholders. They started to produce diversified food, autosufficiency, starting to produce for always producing for local markets, and all these right now we feel that are threatened. So our very existence and life is threatened. So yeah, that is basically Eco Ruralis as an organization, and we are part of since 2012 we are part of La Via Campesina, which is the international movement of peasants, a global movement of peasants. And since a couple of years, one of our board members is also a board member of the coordination committee of La Via, of European Coordination Via Campesina, which we feel it's our offering towards the more general European movement, and somehow to bring the Eastern European perspective, which we feel Romania represents very well, but not completely.
Yeah. I want to chat more with you about the Eastern European strategy for land, and I'll come to that in a bit. But we have another member of Via Campesina, or that's a member of the Dutch organization that's a member of the European Via Campesina.
Yeah.
It's in Dutch, we call it Toekomstboeren.
Yeah.
Can you explain, Joke, what that means for the non-Dutch speakers?
Bluntly translated, Toekomstboeren means future farmers. The reason behind choosing this name is that this type of... It relates both to future farmers in the sense of people who want, who have the wish, the desire to become a farmer, to enter into a world of farming and find a way into it, as well as relating to the sense of farming for the future, farming in a way that is sustainable, really sustainable, that can, in a way that we could do for 1,000 years and still the earth would be healthy enough and the environment would be sustainable enough to feed us and to nurture us.
And that is also forward-looking, like what Attila said, you know, yeah. This is not about a peasantry stuck in time, right? I mean, this is about building on generations of farming knowledge, but constantly evolving and constantly looking towards the future as well.
Right? Yeah, well, food and farming works with natural elements. Without the soil, without the weather, without the plants and the animals, there is no food and there is no farming. So also farming policy evolves always and it never is a static thing. I mean, the whole, for me, I would say it's very important to have a little bit of understanding of the history of farming policy and how we got to where we are now, because a lot of people are in many ways disconnected from food. Food is a produce, food is something that needs to be quick or convenient or cheap. It's an afterthought, especially in Netherlands or Western Europe. We have very busy lifestyles. So the idea that food relates to politics or has an impact on our environment is an alien thing. But it's very understandable and I feel connected to it because the present situation in food and farming in Europe comes from a simple background where a Dutch Minister of Agriculture shortly after Second World War said, "Never be hungry again." And that's a very, very powerful feeling. When you have known hunger, you'll do almost anything, including eat poisonous fruit to not be hungry. But already Mansholt regretted a lot of his implementation towards simply producing a larger amount of food and disregarding the quality of the food a bit. And this is gone so far now that we have a fairly poisoned food and farming system, and that without that we don't, at least in Netherlands, often don't think about our food anymore. It's simply something we put on our plate, and farming policy we think, yeah, that's far from our bed, but really it's on our plate every day, and we literally put poison in our bodies because we want fairly convenient food, which therefore is farmed using poisons. So it's every day on our plate instead of far away in Brussels or in politics. And we are so, for me, the food and the farming is a way to connect again. First of all, not be hungry, but second of all, to connect and take a bit of responsibility back, because I like eating meat. I'm not a vegetarian, I'm not even a vegan. But that piece of steak I eat, I don't want it to contribute to the burning of the forest in Brazil, which is on the news recently. I want to know that that cow has had a good life and has been fed well.
And can you say a bit how Toekomstboeren, how you see the role, the political role, and perhaps also the movement building, certainly also the movement building role of Toekomstboeren, in that, in remedying a bit that disconnect that you spoke about? I mean, Toekomstboeren is quite a young organization, right?
Yep.
So could you also speak a bit about how Toekomstboeren got started and the kind of members and the profile of the people that are attracted to Toekomstboeren?
Yeah, again, it starts with a little bit the background. Dutch food and farming system became very, very successful at this never be hungry thing. And Netherlands is one of the smaller countries in the world, and we are one of the larger producers of food in the world. What we managed to squeeze out of a square meter, well, of soil, but in many cases in the famous greenhouses, it's no longer soil that we grow on, and it's quite amazing. But it has its limits, and so there's a growing movement of people saying, hey, maybe this current system of food and farming doesn't work so well, and maybe we should change something. So from certain agricultural related projects from the University of Wageningen, and a group of students started talking with farmers and peasants and saying, hey, things, maybe we need to organize ourselves a little bit, maybe we need to look into how we can find more healthy, more logical and sustainable ways of food and farming. And that's how only 4 years ago Toekomst Boeren was started. Again, a small group of people like Eco Ruralis and like La Via Campesina are big example in many ways. So yeah, now Toekomst Boeren, 4 years later, has 300 members, and every week or month new members are coming. Beginning of this year, the national CSA network, CSA being Community Supported Agriculture, it's a very connected and direct selling way of producing and sharing food or selling food. And also, together with TNI that Sylvia is with, we make a very good report on Grond van Bestaan, which basically is the foundation of the land and the farming situation. And this was the starting point to get together a federation of agroecological farmers and farming organizations. Because also in the Netherlands, like you say, in Romania and like in the UK, there's a lot of talking about farmers and a lot of talking about food and food policy, but there's hardly any talking with the farmers. That includes, in my perspective, the conventional farmers. Because also most of the conventional farmers don't farm because they think they can get rich from it. They farm because they love food, because they love the land, and because they love their animals. It's just a squeeze in the policy that drives them towards making choices that are not very healthy. So yeah, this is how Toekomst Boeren tries to bring together marginalized people, especially in Netherlands, where entrepreneurship is often a very individual thing, and where our type of farmers farm in a way that doesn't fit within the system. So each of us needs to find a way, and we have a lot of obstacles in common, rules and regulations that do not fit, but also a lot of opportunities in common. So we, like the one straw revolution that you, Samson, already mentioned, if we stand together, many straws are difficult to break. So when we organize ourselves, we become more visible, we are slowly becoming a gesprekspartner, a talking partner for national governance. So slowly the Dutch government is starting to realize, hey, maybe there is an alternative to this industrial farming.
I wanted to drill down a little bit more onto land, more specifically. And I want to talk a bit about the movement building access points when it comes to land. And I particularly want to think about, because we've heard now from two experiences of building up a peasant's voice, an agroecological farmer's voice. And on the one hand, we've heard some success stories, you know, in terms of really growing the membership, taking a stance in some political debates, being seen and being visible and being recognized and being valued, you know, and how powerful that is again. But there are also challenges, you know, and there are also people that are not still included in the movement and which we perhaps don't always talk about enough and are not always perhaps so intentional enough about. I want to just kind of hear some of your perspectives on that. So perhaps Samson, I can have a bit of your sort of take on things from your experiences. I mean, you have this kind of great line of, you know, we're not going back to the land, we're going forward to the land, because it's this kind of forward vision, you know, because going back sort of seems to imply a sort of a back to archaic kind of pre-industrial time, which is often a way to sideline also the kinds of points that we want to make in debate. So perhaps I could ask you something like, who do you think is part of this forward to the land movement, and who can we still reach out to more?
Yeah, so I mean that, yeah, forward to the land. I wrote my thesis about the land rights movement in the UK, and I called it Forward to the Land because of like this stigma or the ideas behind land-based livelihoods that exist within society. And they're rooted in an idea of progress that that is quite explicitly taught in Western economics or Western kind of hegemony, that you move from an agricultural society to an industrial society. So there's that element that I wanted to kind of challenge with that wording. And I think the there's also an important thing before I kind of go there, is that in the England it's quite a different scenario than, for example, in Romania or other parts of Europe, in the sense that the peasants were destroyed in the 1750s onwards, earlier than even in most parts of Europe, because of the enclosure of common land. And actually the word peasant became used to describe an agricultural labour in a agrarian capitalist system. So it's very interesting because rather than peasant, you know, in the English lexicon or in the debates, rather than peasant being used to describe like the free sovereign kind of common landholder, they became to mean the epitome of
well, it's a term of
exploitation.
It's now very derogatory. Yeah.
So reclaiming that word is really important, and I'm also very conscious of the nuances in the political struggles that we face in the UK in gaining access to land, how they differ from the political struggles in Brazil, you know, whereby, you know, farmers, or in Romania also, but like today we heard about the political struggle against a mining company for a whole village to lose their land. But again, in Brazil or in the global south, there's different political struggles whereby peasants face different issues. And I think it comes back around to what I imagine as a future. I'm interested in asking questions that we're not really asking enough, which is, in the UK, for example, most new entrant farmers are from a middle class white background. There's privilege involved in being able to make that transition back to the land. And I think we have to start questioning, and like, it's not the only story, it's not the only dominant story, because there are incredible, like, often urban focused land and farming and food justice projects that are happening all over the place that are centering people of color, for example, or they're creating spaces within communities that are often marginalized to gain some sovereignty over their access to food, to healthy food. So I think a lot about what we need to do to further that along. How do we create a land justice movement that is welcoming to people of color in the UK, in England, for example? And I wonder what are we not doing enough of in that sense. And there's another thing. And yeah, there's also a lot of issues come around the stigmas for people who are from colonized nations who've ended up living in Western nations. There's stigmas ancestral stigmas around farming as like a backwards thing and living in. So we have to constantly challenge those, I think. Challenge those stigmas.
The histories of exploitation.
There's a different, there's a wonderful movement in the US started by Leah Pennyman, her books just came out called Farming While Black, who talks about those kind of historical struggles that make liberation on the land for her a huge kind of step away out of trauma, out of ancestral trauma. And also, so I'm wondering how we can start asking these questions more. Yeah. But I also don't want to undermine we have the Land Workers Alliance in the UK who are like incredible work. I mean, they're in the room for most discussions around farming now. They're influencing things, but obviously we've got Brexit, so it's like, who knows how that's going to end up. Where you wanted to go with it as well?
Yeah. No, I was like tempted to go the Brexit, that's going to be a whole tangent in the podcast, and I think that's going to be specifically my podcast on Europhobia, Euroscepticism, rise of authoritarianism. I'll save that for that. Do you guys have any kind of, thoughts on that as well about? Who are we including, but who is also not including that we should, reach out to more? One of the things perhaps Ilka, I wanted to get you to talk about a bit is, because I think it's such a strength of Toekomstboeren is, the average age of a farmer in the Netherlands, like most of Europe, is somewhere in the 50s or?
Closer to 60.
Close to 60, right? I don't know how much percentage is men?
Mostly.
Mostly, exactly. But, Toekomstboeren is, kind of...
young and a lot of women.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So perhaps can you talk about the young women a bit more?
Farming in many countries, but especially Western Europe, is a male-dominated business in general. The only farms that manage to survive these days are the struggle of the fittest. So the fittest, the most bossy ones, the bigger, the more commercial, big tractors, big plows, big fields. These are the ones that survive. This tends to be a male, in my personal opinion, a male way of doing, of male way of working. So a lot of people think, in Netherlands, feminism is very well succeeded, and yes, it's very true. Women have acquired the right in 100 years to go about work and business in the same way men do. We still don't get paid equal wages for equal work, but we're allowed to work in exactly the same way as men do, and therefore make the same mistakes and go the same way. Whereas every March 8, which is International Women's Day, the newspapers are full of stories about women in men's jobs. They all say the same thing. How wonderful it is in many cases that there is a woman in a male-dominated world because a woman approaches this work differently. Now, I'm all in favor for equal worth for male and female or gender neutrality. But I'm also thinking, in general terms, men approach things different than women do. And I would like to have the right to run my business and operate in a female way, which does look more to the inner space, which tend to be smaller scale, less investment required, starting at lower risk and from this slowly building, because don't mistake the big corporations that certain women internationally have built. But we like to start more slowly. A friend, a female farming friend, said, yeah, I find that in my farming work, but also she's a mathematics teacher. She says, when women know 120% of something that they need to know for a certain task or enterprise, by the time they know 120%, they say, yeah, well, I think I might know enough to do this. And she says, in general, when a man knows about 50%, he says, ah, yeah, man, I can do this. No worries, I fix it, I do it. I borrow some from the bank and my friends will back me up, we make it. It's, of course, an exaggeration a bit.
Nice.
But
pretty accurate.
Yeah, so. New entrant farming in Netherlands, but also in a few other countries I've been to, it tends to start with vegetable farming, vegetable growing. That tends to be more gardening, that tends to be small scale, diversified, starting locally, relating to the inner space. So that tends to be more women's business, to pick an archaic term. Mm-hmm. And I see this on my boyfriend of 60, but yeah, still my boyfriend. Farm, he farms large scale, he runs around with huge tractors, and they're also the more inner space elements of the farm. All the cows are being taken care of by women, and also all the protective cropping, all the polytunnel growing is being cared for by the women. The food for all the lunch, because they is done. It's a very stereotyped gender divide, but my opinion says that's not necessarily a bad thing. So Toekomstboeren has a lot of women, not because all the women of Toekomstboeren would agree with this opinion and viewpoint of mine, but because there are opportunities for women to work this way. And because also there are opportunities for young people to work this way, because you have more the flexibility to try out things when you don't have children to take care of yet, or even more when you don't have a high mortgage to pay. Then you're in a stronghold or a stranglehold as well. So yeah, it's a...
Do you call it a kind of feminist way of farming, or is that not discussed in that way?
I do it sometimes, but a lot of people don't think this is a topic at the moment, and I would agree that at the moment this is not an important enough topic to discuss it that way. I do believe emancipation is a very important form in this. Emancipation in the broadest sense, to emancipate ourselves, to make ourselves stronger, to find the examples and learn alternative ways, because a lot of people think there is no alternative way to farming than the industrial way. If you ask people in the Netherlands how much percentage of the world food is grown or produced in non-industrial ways of farming, 5%, 10% maybe, or even less are the answers I usually get. As we know, the real answer is 70% of the world food is produced in non-industrial ways. Mm-hmm. So that's the majority. But we tend to forget. We tend to forget that industry does not dominate. We tend to forget that high investment is not the be-all and end-all of things. So therefore, young people tend to be a little bit more aware, because when you grow up in a world that is based on the capitalist thinking, when you grow up in a world that only says, yeah, well, you need 120 milking cows and you inherit the loan from the bank and so on. When this is the world that you know, you can't really be expected to suddenly step outside it.
I want to... ask a bit, you, Attila. I mean, we're talking about who's included and who's not included. I know that Eco Ruralis is celebrating its 10-year anniversary this year. You have your general assembly. I don't know if you're in a particular sort of reflective mode because of that, but I was wondering if you could kind of, I mean, looking back at sort of 10 years of Eco Ruralis, and particularly I'm interested here in your kind of land strategy. Like, has that evolved over those 10 years? Have you seen changes, successes, but also setbacks? How do you analyze where you're at with your land strategy in 2019.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good switch from the other discussion. Although I had a few comments there too, but we can talk.
If you want, I mean.
Yeah. It's just that it's very interesting, and I think it leads back to land. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that the realities are so parallel, but sometimes so different, because what you said about masculinity and scale is that there are millions of peasant farmers in Romania, and although indeed job division is more towards strength to male and delicacy towards women, indeed there is this division which some call it because of the way peasant farming, you know, it's very labor intensive and so on, and whatever reasons, I don't want to go into that, but it's not necessarily true on the scale, for instance, and tractors and so on and so forth. And what we see is that actually in Romania, peasant farmers, which are male, they work a lot with their hands. They work a lot. Yes, strength is a big deal in it, but not necessarily the grandomania, because peasants learn to work in communities, to work each other's respect each other's boundaries, but also to not to overgrow. And this leads to land, because in peasant societies, even now in modern Romania, peasant societies are very diverse and very fragmented when it comes to land ownership or land stewardship. If somebody grows out of that dimension, which could be 2 hectares, 1 hectare, 10 hectares per farmer, depending on the area, then it tends to over-bully the rest of the... tends to outgrow being a peasant and become what we call a farmer. Because in Romania, it's a very contested word. Like you would insult. You would not insult, but you would really... It's a strong word to say, well, are you a farmer? Like, no, I'm a peasant. Mm. So to be a farmer is to be the masculine, plow your way through it in deep plow, use a lot of fertilizer, just throw the money around, just do half measures and you think you can do it, kind of farming. That's the farming that is the more masculine-oriented farming. And the more gender-balanced farming is what we see is this peasant farming, which is respecting really nature, respecting scale also. So that's my point a little bit. And maybe that's different. And I can totally understand visiting also the Netherlands, what you say. I definitely saw it. So it's true.
Something.
Yeah, please do. Please do, because it's feminist.
I think what is really important is that what that brings to light is we're talking about how if you're socialized as a man, if you're socialized as a woman, so the qualities of expectations of a masculinity and femininity create in our society is exactly what you described, because people have been socialized into an industrial capitalist way of being, so therefore, and then in Romania, there's still probably gender discrimination and separation, but there's differences within the social context of a peasant movement. So what that speaks to as well is the possibility of moving beyond those things, of creating new ways of thinking and being. And we definitely need to feminize our farming. That's bring femininity to the practices of farming. And there's no doubt that capitalism and patriarchy are in the same bed, and they're rooted in the same thing. And that, so it's to challenge capitalism, I think you also have to challenge patriarchy throughout. And farming is definitely not, it's definitely a big part of that. Vandana Shiva says everything we need to hear about how to feminize our connection to land and farming.
But also to learn that we do not need to be afraid of scale. Mm. We can, this way of farming, agroecological farming, is very often connected to small scale. And while this has great value and very good grounds, it is also possible. I mean, in this sense, we talk about small scale is usually 5 hectares or less. It gets to 50 hectares, but when it gets to 100 hectares, a lot of people say, wow, this is really big. Whereas in many conventional cases, a farm of 500 hectares is a fairly average size, in general in Europe. Mm-hmm. In Eastern Germany, a few thousand hectares happens. In Romania, I don't know.
Different.
Yeah, it varies a lot. In Netherlands, you might know this better than I do.
There's a huge there are huge national differences. I mean, across the whole EU 28, still. I think the average farm size is 14.5 hectares, mm-hmm. so still yeah. very, but that hides away huge, huge differences, you know, yeah. in national averages. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that being on scale and land, to turn to the land question, yep. Is the fact indeed that what we realized that 10 years ago, one of the factors that brought together farmers was also scale, saying that they observed that the farming landscape around them is changing, around yep. us is changing. So that means that we see, and then this kind of like wording has been born that I don't know my neighbor anymore.
Yeah.
So that means I don't really have a neighbor anymore. And who's my neighbor? Who's that guy who just bought 1,000 hectares near yep. me? Does anybody know that guy? It's not a guy, it's a company. We don't have a face around it. It's just a company. How did he ever get that money to buy all that land? You know, so all these questions arise, and also what kind of effect does it will have on us? So these were the driving questions that led to the land program of Eco Ruralis, well, roughly 8 years ago, because in the first year we were born and groomed. Mm. But then after that, in 2 years' time, we thought it already, like, we put the question of the what is too big, what is the dynamic in the land market, especially in highly populated peasant areas, where already we were getting the signals that big investors are coming, buying up the land, and it's too yeah. big, and it has environmental effects because of the monocultures, it has social effects because of unemployment and pushing out of the people of the land, and all these horror stories that people were kicked out in the middle of the night, and, you know, land grabbing in its brute force.
Yeah.
So we were like, okay, but that's not land grabbing. Land grabbing is something for Africa or Asia. It's like we don't have land. We have regulated land markets. We are in the European continent, and we have cadastry and whatever. And, you know, it's like land grabbing cannot happen here. Like, come on. So an enlightening moment in our quest and the program was actually with TNI. Because together with we had an intern at that moment, and she wanted to really work on land inside the Eco Ruralis, and they said, fine, it's a new story for us, so really let's search it out together. And that was the converging moment when T and I, together with the European Coordination Via Campesina, were building up the book, the report, Land Concentration, Land Grabbing and People's Struggles in Europe. So that was, and Romania became a case study. And boom, we realized that after studying very in depth Romania, that we have a huge problem with concentration in Romania. There's a lot of land grabbing going on, yeah. illegalities, a lot of multinational hedge funds investing into Romania, many of them managed by Dutch banks.
Yeah.
So we realized that the intersection and land concentration and intersection with the peasant, it already has begun, and it already has a large effect over the peasantry. So what it came in the following years, it was a lot of transparency work. It's not really our job, we are not journalists. We shouldn't do this. We should farm. No, like that's our job. But the question that drove us is, who is your neighbor, and also, is your neighbor a good person or a bad person? What kind of effect does it have on you, and how will it disturb the rural dwellings? You know, our rural dynamics. And suddenly we started to work a lot on fact sheets, we started to work a lot on reports, we started to work a lot on all kinds of transparency work, and feed that work inside media, to fellow civil society, to the government, to show that there's a problem in Romania regarding land. And that led us to a strategy which was twofolded. One is to as peasants, to take control of this information and to highlight and to measure as peasants, what is land grabbing? How is it unfolding in Romania? What effects does it have? Who are the actors behind it? To put faces and names, to find a lot of information on this, so that we can be very statistically driven when we make our political claims. Not just people saying, these peasants, they are so poetical, and now they're romantic, they're asking more yeah. land, or whatever their lands, you know. So to really put stories and facts behind that. So we were quite successful with that, I would say. We started to build up a campaign on this, and we created maps and all kinds of stuff, video documentaries, and yes, it was very well exposed, I would say. So that was a good strategy, but constantly what we were facing is the second part that we developed later of the land strategy, which was like, okay, but what do you propose, what is the alternative, like, okay, besides you doing what you do, So besides maintaining the control of land in the hands of peasants, how do you see the future? You know, like, because there's already a big concentration, there's already communism left a lot of scars, and a lot of lands are owned by the state and which are concessioned out to big companies. So what are your plans with that? You know, like, what is the role of the citizen also in this?
Exactly.
With the consumer, yes, you know? Yeah. So then we said, okay, we have started working on the alternative, and since 2014 we are part of the Access to Land Network, which brings us today together, and we started to pioneer really out all kinds of alternative ways, or innovative ways should I say, on securing land for agroecology, which agroecology, we believe peasant agroecology is our driving concept. So we started to really figure out how can we bring communities together in order to put their money where their mouth is, in saving land, mm-hmm. in safeguarding land, in building up policies on around access to land and stuff like that. So that's where we are now, that we have a campaign that is running on two roads. One is really proposing the solutions coming from the grassroots movement of peasants, but also innovating through the road of the Access to Land Network, let's say, and other initiatives from mainly Western Europe also, but our country is getting westernized also in this process. And also figuring out, because in 2016 we have done a report which is called Farm Succession in Romania, which nails down that in 20 years we will have a huge change in the farming community, because the average age of a small farmer in Romania is 65. So that means that we have a huge problem of the next generation. So in next years, we will, that's why it's interesting, we will have a Tokensboden a question.
Yeah.
So and even now, because we see a lot of migration also going on to Romania, out of Romania, you know, a lot of young people, especially young farmer children, seeking for a new life because they're being pushed out by the social context in their villages.
Yeah, but you also touch on a very important other point. And without the farmers, no food.
Mm.
Although some people would say different, because food comes these days from the factory, but still, without the farmer, no real food. So the whole policy story, we talk a lot about agrarian, common agricultural policy, and land grabbing and big institutions, and a lot of people think, yeah, but as an individual citizen, I can't really do anything about this. But that basically is bullshit. Because it's everywhere. That basically is not true. Nonsense.
Good.
Because it's every day on our food. And you mention also the landscape and what do our villages look like. As citizens, we want a nice looking landscape with the cows in the field and some flowers and lots of different animals and birds. But in 30 years' time, we managed to get rid of more than 75% of all insects. That's a huge amount. And most of the farms and the agricultural fields are getting very manicured and very clean, and there's almost no diversity in color and size and shape anymore. No, of course not, because it has to be as efficient as possible. That takes out the variety, the color, the joy, the diversity and the life of it.
So yeah, that's kind of like what we're trying to preserve. Because,
but that also means that people need to pay more for the food.
Yes and no, depending on the country, people need to source their food from different channels, like not okay, but that maybe that's not the
different debate.
Yeah, different debate, because the market debate is to get my point back is that regarding the land strategy of Eco Ruralis is that we set out on a very nice and very hard road, like work into mapping out the differences and the social struggle around land in Romania. We kind of feel that we have done that, and we also sparkle the interest of citizens to look at that and to monitor that, and also to decide politically and vote politically also based on that. So that is interesting. But we are 10 years since we have been established, and we are in a moment when we feel that although of all these transparency work and although all these community work and organizing peasant work, we still, lots of the lands are being lost and being bought away. So you cannot stop the, let's say, how you say, the big tractor of agro industry, you know. So now the strategy is, okay, what to do? And we increased much more, and our new strategy is also to increase much more our political articulation. Because we said, okay, but until laws don't impede the development of this, until laws don't safeguard lands, until laws don't stop land grabbing and reverse its effects, we cannot have functional peasant societies and societies in general. So we started to do a lot of policy work, so analyzing laws, looking at the European dimension, because we are part of EU. When we started, we were at the start. We started to involve ourselves into articulation of new kinds of laws, like to dream about how, what kind of laws do we want to see in the future to safeguard peasants, not just in Romania, but in our Eastern European situation, in Europe in general. So it really, it really, we really started to work together, and now with TNI and with in the European Commission via Campesina and the Access to Land Network, to sort of go towards a legislation, better legislation, a more fair, more just legislation on land. How that will come out, that's a common strategy, I think. It's not too small for Eco Ruralis.
No, it's fundamentally needed and a common interest and goal for all, all of us, I think.
That's that will be a sort of hopefully a step two in the podcast when we perhaps have one in a year's time. We have had some more fully fleshed out proposal on that. I mean, speaking of food sovereignty, I think, you know, our food sovereignty is going to come up in right now. But I just want to say thank you so much for all of you for being part of it. I was really touched at certain moments when you were speaking. I thought we actually got some really profound thoughts out of all of you. Just before we, before we go, I just, if any of you wants to say anything as a sort of a final thought or quotes or... Any final words, but otherwise we will go.
I'll just say thanks to both of you, Attila and Jolke. Really, like, amazing to hear your stories and to be sat in the circle. I feel quite honoured. I think for me there's a, you know, there's this urgency of this moment we're in, whereby there isn't, there's not much hiding to do behind the problems that we're facing in terms of climate breakdown. So there's a, there's an opportunity to become quite radical in what we can do. And I think we need to start seizing the opportunity as in our communities, you know, we need to start kind of really, really resisting, because the moment is dangerous. It can go both ways, you know, like when nations have, you know, fear over resources, they can either create alliances, you know, with each other and with, or they can become fearful of the other and close borders. And we're already seeing mass climate migration. We need to start asking questions about how we can deal with these and how that's going to affect how we're growing food and living on the land. So I'm hopeful from this conversation that we have some good people to help with that.
Yeah, I too would say I believe there is hope. There is definitely hope. There's a growing movement. Every year we are general and collective movements. We are with more and we are growing, literally and figuratively.
Yeah, and from my side, the last thing is that also listening to the podcast of TNI, I really enjoyed them, and in that light also I want to say that that all these discussions that we're having in a Eurosceptic area, in this divided Europe, in this politics that is withdrawing to populism and fundamentalism and totalitarianism and so on, I feel like I can say as us as peasants and food growers, we give a lesson here about solidarity, about unity, about how we can create holistic systems. And we are doing political examples here. So I just want to thank really everybody that is involved into this. It is very nice to see, hear your stories. I was also touched many times. And yeah, this is how it should be done, discussing and then with a lot of passion and with a lot of going down to the ground and to the grassroots and building from that. And then, yeah, it was great.
Thank you, guys.
This is the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. Many thanks to our guests, Attila Socks, Yolke Demurl, and Samson Hart. And a special thanks to Sylvia Kay, who hosted the conversation. If you'd like to find out more about some of what was discussed, please look up our policy report, Roots of Resilience, Land Policy for an Agroecological Transition in Europe. This policy report argues that it is time to rediscover the roots of our resilience by grounding land policy in collective action and democratic forms of land politics. This is based on an understanding of land not as a commodity, but as a common resource, a living territory, and a natural landscape. It corresponds closely with the philosophy of land stewardship, a deep and abiding relationship to land that is based on caretaking and an appreciation that land is held in trust for now and for future generations. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to give us a rating or a review on whichever platform you're receiving the podcast from. Your feedback will help us to create better content for you. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you for listening. And please take a moment today to consider all the peasant farmers who have brought food to your table. See you next time.